The headlines. Iran blames Israel for the recent terrorist attack on a defense facility in Aswan, saying it reserves a right to respond to such actions. Intense fighting is reported between Russian and Ukrainian forces for the control of the city of Bakhmut in the eastern Donbass region. And also calls are growing for accountability and an end to U.S. police brutality as a funeral service is held for a black man recently killed by Memphis police. Hello and welcome everybody. Iran's ambassador to the UN says a preliminary investigation shows Israel was responsible for Saturday's terrorist attack on a military site in the central Iranian city of Isfahan. Saidi Ravani also pointed out Israeli Prime Minister's recent interview with U.S. media in which he admitted to, quote, taking action against certain weapons development sites in Iran. Iravani called Israel's assault a brazen violation of international law and urged the UN Security Council to hold the regime accountable. The Iranian diplomat stressed that his country reserves the right to defend its national security and respond to any aggression or threats by Israel. Iravani also condemned as provocative and irresponsible a tweet by Ukraine's presidential adviser on the drone attack in which he alleged Iran for providing weapons to Russia. This is while Tehran has repeatedly denied giving weapons to Moscow to be used in the Ukraine war. Iran says that it regrets the latest stance of the International Atomic Energy Agency on the country's nuclear program. Iran's nuclear chief, Mohammad Islami, said the IAEA inspector had reported to the agency incorrect interpretation on Tehran. He added that the inspector found out his error of judgment after the Islamic Republic provided explanations to the UN nuclear watchdog the same day. On Wednesday, the IAEA accused Iran of substantially modifying an interconnection between two centrifuge clusters enriching uranium. In a report, it also alleged Iran for possible uranium enrichment up to 60% purity at its Fordow nuclear plant. We're going to go back to our top story. Iran's ambassador to the UN says that a preliminary investigation shows Israel was responsible for the terrorist attack on a military site in the central Iranian city of Isfahan. For more insight on that story, we're now joined by political analyst Fouad Izadi, who's with us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Also, we have political analyst Sayed Mostafa Khoshcheshm, who's with us from Tehran as well. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. First of all, let's start off with Mr. Izadi. Give us your perspective on how events have transpired since Saturday. Also, the message that was read out by Iran's ambassador to the UN, blaming Israel.
You know, Iran is obviously taking a stand. What the Zionist entity has done is illegal under international law. You're not supposed to attack another country without resolution from the UN Security Council. The Zionists occupying Palestine don't have UN resolution for attacking Iran. And Iran has, obviously, has the right to respond. And this is not the first time Israelis have done that. So this is quite serious, and people could have gotten killed if it wasn't for Iranian defense systems. And overall, I think as the Israelis engage in these type of illegal activities with the full support of the United States and a number of other Western countries, these countries should not blame Iran for the consequences of this type of actions.
Same question to Mr. Khoshcheshm as well. Walk us through the recent comments made by Iran's ambassador. The preliminary investigation has indicated that Israel was responsible for Saturday's terrorist attack on a military site in the central Iranian city of Isfahan. Also, if you may add to that notion what Israel is trying to achieve.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for having me. Well, this is not an isolated case. This is just one in chain of attacks that have been conducted on Iranian nuclear facilities as well as military facilities by the Israelis, but within the hybrid warfare plan masterminded by the United States that also includes battles an area of cyberspace, also in foreign currency meddling in Iran, and instigating riots, as well as war of perception, media warfare, and so on and so forth. Terror and assassination, as well as cyber attacks, have been carried out by the Israeli regime. And according to the Israeli media, they have never been left unanswered. This is at least what the Israeli media have been acknowledging in the past couple of years, including attacks for Israel a few months later. Mark was assassinated by the Israeli regime. The father of the Israeli aerospace program, Avi Har-Avin, was killed, stabbed to death 100 times, according to Times of Israel, at a place that was a cover-up place, actually, a center of the Israeli aerospace program at the heart of Israel. A few months after the attack, Natanz, 1.5 years ago, nearly 2 years ago, I believe, their largest ballistic missile manufacturing plant near Tel Aviv, that's called Ofer, that manufactures different types of ballistic missiles for satellite carriers, as well as for carrying WMD warheads, experienced a blast that was observed.
All right, unfortunately, we've lost that connection. Hopefully, we'll get Mr. Khoshchesh back on the program. Let's cross over once again to Mr. Fouadizadeh. Let's talk about the response to this. The Iranian ambassador, Mr. Iravani, has called Israel's assault a brazen violation of international law and urged the UN Security Council to hold the regime accountable. Give us your thoughts on that statement. We've seen plenty times before where the United Nations, specifically the UNSC, fails to implement or censure Israel in any way, shape, or form.
You know, this is why the UN was created. This is why you have the Security Council. The idea was that if a country is attacked without permission from the UN Security Council, then the UN Security Council needs to condemn that attack. And if these type of attacks continue, then the UN Security Council normally, in normal cases, puts that country under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, which would allow military action against that country that is violating international law and attacking others. They generally start with Chapter 6 sanctions. They sanction that particular country. And if the sanctions don't stop these type of attacks, then they put the country, the violator, under Chapter 7. And unfortunately, we have not seen any of that. And the reason is because of the United States. As I said, the Israeli regime is engaging in this type of illegal attacks with the full support of the United States, and the U.S. is shielding the Israeli regime at the U.N. If it was a normal situation, the Israelis would not be able to repeat this type of attacks. And what the United States is saying is that we will go to the negotiating table, get some concessions out of Iran, and the concessions that we didn't get at the negotiating table will have the Israelis attack those sites that we could not negotiate over and get what we want through Israeli attacks. So what the Americans are saying is that either you give us concessions at the negotiating table, or we will destroy the areas that we were not successful in negotiating about. And this is obviously not acceptable. And to be honest with you, you know, all these type of activities at the end of the day have strengthened Iran's nuclear program and military programs. And, you know, we have Israeli supporters in the United States that are criticizing these type of attacks because they don't achieve much. The Iran's nuclear program, peaceful nuclear program, is advancing significantly. They don't achieve much, and they give Iran an opportunity to actually strengthen its peaceful nuclear program, given the attacks that Iran is receiving. So overall, the Israelis and the Americans are not achieving their goals. This is a failed policy. They're destroying some sites. They have assassinated people. That's all they get. They don't change the direction of Iran's nuclear program. And they give Iran an excuse to respond to these type of attacks in a serious manner, and we have seen instances of that in the past.
All right, we have Mr. Khoshesh with us once again, but he's now on the line with us from Tehran. Mr. Khoshesh, I want you to pick up where you left off. And also, if you may add to that, the issue that we were just discussing with Mr. Izadi is that an Iranian diplomat at the UN, he stressed that his country reserves a right to defend its national security and respond to any aggression or threats by Israel. So basically, this kind of activity by the Israeli regime could backfire on it. And also about the lack of action from the United Nations and the United Nations Security Council in this regard as well.
I'm sorry about that. I mean, I was disconnected. But, as I was telling you, these kind of attacks come within the framework of hybrid warfare that's been conducted by the United States in pursuit of short, mid, and long-term goals. And the short-term goal is pushing Iran back at the negotiating table. And this is not going to happen. This has not happened actually in the last two rounds of this hybrid warfare in spring and fall. And but it's going to have costs to be inflicted on the masterminds as well as those that have done the attacks, as this has been the case before. We've all experienced, I mean, according to the Israeli media and officials, there has been a tit for tat on the way for all the past several years, and this is going to continue. But I do believe sincerely that Iran's patience is going out of limit. Now, as Iran's IRGC Hot Force commander stated just last month, there have been some 40 to 50 operations only in the West Bank each week. Sometimes on a single day, there have been 10 operations. The Palestinians, the resistance front, everyone is exhausted with Israeli atrocities. So there will be repercussions if the UN Security Council fails to condemn these attacks and to stop these attacks. Iran is powerful enough to provide a response, and Iran's response will not come just within isolated cases once for each of these attacks, but it will be it will come within a package to punish actually those that have been thinking of harming Iran. As you could see from the outcome of the attack on the workshop at the munition plant in Isfahan in central or southern Iran, they failed because Iran has been learning the lesson all throughout the past four decades. They've been conducting similar attacks, terror attacks, sabotage attacks, assassinations, and so on and so forth. And Iran has learned the lesson how to combat these attacks. Just take a look at the Iranian technology, drone technology across the Middle East and elsewhere. According to the CENTCOM commander last year, he stated that they have lost air superiority to Iranian drones after seven decades. And now you could imagine what would happen to Israel or anyone else that Iran wants to punish only with its missiles and drones. So this is going to cost the Israelis, who are now experiencing a bipolar society right now. They are weaker than ever. And they will be weaker than ever as internal domestic differences among the Zionists are growing. So it's no good time for them to play such foolish acts, but definitely it's going to cost both Israel and the United States soon in the future if they continue this hybrid warfare for coming weeks and months.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Political analyst Fouad Izadi joining us from Tehran. Also, thanks to political analyst Said Mostafa Khoshchesh joining us on the line from the Iranian capital. Moving on, Ukraine has reported more casualties in the eastern Donbass region as Russia intensifies its attacks. Ahead of the first anniversary of its military operation there, the Ukrainian military says Russian forces have struck the city of Bakhmut in Donetsk province and at least 10 nearby towns and villages. Separately, Ukrainian police say Russian missile strikes on several apartment buildings in the eastern city of Kramatorsk have left 3 people dead and 20 others injured. President Volodymyr Zelensky says the situation has become tougher as Russia is seeking for more gains before February the 24th. That's the day when Russia began its offensive against Ukraine last year. Zelensky has already requested for new weapons and their fast deliveries from his Western backers. Elsewhere, Americans are calling for an end to police brutality as they mourn the killing of Tyre Nichols, an African-American man who was beaten to death by Memphis City Police. People expressed their anger during the funeral of Nichols that was also attended by the U.S. Vice President. Kamala Harris said the act of violence by police was not in line with public safety, adding that people have lost confidence in law enforcement agencies and do not feel safe. Nichols was arrested by the police in early January for a traffic violation. He was viciously beaten by 5 officers at the scene and succumbed to his injuries there 3 days later. The 5 policemen who were also African-American have since been fired by the Memphis Police Department and charged with second-degree murder. That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Men and women as human beings are completely equal in Islam. This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, meeting with hundreds of prominent Iranian women in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on January 4, 2023. If you are caught in a situation where you have to choose between saving a child's life and working in an office, the child's life comes first. Do you have any doubts about this? No. No woman has any doubt that a child's life comes first if she's in a situation where she has to choose between a child's life and working in an office. When there is a truly significant, crucial obligation, it can become even more important than the life of a child. However, in normal matters, in other cases, the core responsibility of a woman revolves around her family. It is truly impossible to manage a family without a woman being present, without her endeavors, and without a woman's sense of duty. Things do not get managed. Things cannot be managed without a woman. Sometimes there are small problems in the family that cannot be resolved without the gentle touch of a woman. No matter how strong and capable a man is, he cannot solve some of these problems. These subtle problems and sometimes complicated problems can only be handled by a woman's gentle touch. So this was about the family.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Now, regarding the issue of the family, if we look at the issues in the West, it is a disaster. A disaster. The West has broken up families. It has truly destroyed them. Although, when I say that they have destroyed families, I do not mean that families don't exist in the West. They do. Some families are actually good families. They truly are families. The other appears to be a family, but on the inside, they are not. I was reading in a Western American text that in order to really see the children and be a so-called family, the husband and wife set a time to be together. So you come from your office and your wife comes from her office at such and such time to have a tea together in the afternoon at a set time, for example, 4 to 6 p.m. The children come from school too, and they all have a cup of tea together. That is why they call a family. One person goes off and does his own thing. The other stays up late and goes out with friends. This is not a family. It is the appearance of a family. The West has truly broken up families with the various issues that I mentioned earlier, and this has led up to gradual collapse of the families. It has even caused the Western scholars to raise their voices. They themselves, many of their well-wishers, reformists, are paying attention to this and are trying to call people's attention to it. However, I think they do not have a choice anymore. In some Western countries, the downhill slope has become so steep that it can no longer be stopped. They are going downhill. That is, the families cannot be reformed anymore. This was about the issue of the family.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo Jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The U.S. announced on January 25th that it will send 31 M1 Abrams tanks to Ukraine. The tanks may take months or even years to arrive and may never see the battlefield. The M1 Abrams is the main battle tank of the U.S. military and is one of the most powerful and sophisticated tanks in the world. But for Ukraine, that is both the advantage and the problem. In his comments announcing the decision, U.S. President Joe Biden said that delivering the tanks to Ukraine will take time without further specification.
Today, I'm announcing that the United States will be sending 31 Abrams tanks to Ukraine. the equivalent of one Ukrainian battalion. Secretary Austin has recommended this step because it will enhance the Ukraine's capacity to defend its territory and achieve its strategic objectives. The Abrams tanks are the most capable tanks in the world. They're also extremely complex to operate and maintain. So we're also giving Ukraine the parts and equipment necessary to effectively sustain these tanks on the battlefield.
Military analysts say it could take a year or more for all these Abrams to make it to Ukraine. So any expectations that these tanks will have an immediate impact on the fighting needs to be tempered. The tanks will be purchased from General Dynamics, the manufacturer of the tank. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said it will take many months for General Dynamics to build them. Kirby said the U.S. doesn't have the extra tanks in its arsenal, and even if there were excess tanks, it would still take many months, suggesting that the unbuilt tanks will take even longer to arrive. While the estimated timeline suggests that the tanks cannot have an immediate impact on the conflict, it seems that may never have been the intention. The decision may have been more strategic and diplomatic than military. The Biden administration made the decision against the advice of the Pentagon. The tank the U.S. really wants on the battlefields of Ukraine is the German Leopard 2. But Germany was never going to send them without the cover of the U.S. agreeing to send their tanks. In case there was any doubt, on January 19th, at the World Economic Forum, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz privately but very directly told the U.S. delegation that Germany was not going to send their tanks until the U.S. agreed to send theirs. The U.S. may never have intended the Abrams tanks for the current war. They may not even be the right tanks for this war. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley had both recommended against sending M1 Abrams tanks to Ukraine. In addition to how long it takes to train personnel to operate the tanks and how difficult the tanks are to maintain, they have also said that the Abrams tanks are not the right vehicles for the fight in Ukraine right now. By promising to send the tanks without ever specifying a delivery date, the U.S. may have succeeded in giving Germany and Europe cover to send their Leopard tanks without ever actually sending U.S. tanks onto the current battlefield. Most NATO members in Europe have kept open the possibility of sending their F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine, even as U.S. President Joe Biden said Washington would not do so. Air defense experts say U.S.-built F-16 fighter jets would offer Ukraine an edge over the Russian Air Force, but only if combined with powerful missiles and targeting information which the West would also have to provide, drawing it more actively into the war. There are clear advantages to the F-16. It is the world's most produced fighter jet, with many being decommissioned in Europe as NATO members transition to the F-35. Lockheed Martin, which produces the F-16, told the Financial Times it can increase production to replace planes sent to Ukraine. But there are practical and symbolic concerns. Experts say training Ukrainian pilots on F-16s might not be carried out in time to make a difference in the war this year. Also, bringing in Western pilots, even as privateers, could create political complications. Ukraine has reportedly prepared a batch of 50 pilots who have flown in Western military exercises and could be trained in 3 months. The symbolic concern is over losses of aircraft. Russia's development of hypersonic missiles could prove a match for the F-16, ending the narrative of NATO superiority. Perhaps for such reasons, there are still naysayers in the Western alliance. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, after bowing to pressure to send Leopard 2 battle tanks to Ukraine, said he would not be sending the jets. The West, the U.S. in particular, has supplied Ukraine with arms and munitions worth billions of dollars since the beginning of the war in February last year. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has recently doubled down on the need for new weapons from his Western backers to counter Russia's military advances, urging the West to send long-range missiles and fighter jets in addition to tanks.
We have to open the supply of long-range missiles to Ukraine, and it is important that we expand our cooperation in artillery, and we have to start supplying aircraft to Ukraine. This is our dream and our task.
Russia has frequently warned that Western weapons supply to Ukraine will only prolong the war.
While the British public is grappling with an unprecedented cost of living crisis, the dismissal of a high-ranking Tory official has added insult to the injury of millions of Britons. That after it emerged that chairman of the Conservative Party, Nadeem Zahawi, paid a penalty to HM Revenue and Customs over previously unpaid tax as part of a multi-million pound dispute while he was Chancellor. HM Revenue and Customs is a non-ministerial department of the UK government responsible for collecting taxes. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak was quick to react to save his party from yet another scandal. He fired Zahawi for what he called serious breaches of the ministerial code over his tax affairs. An investigation by Sunak's ethics advisor concluded that Zahawi had broken the rules by repeatedly failing to declare an HMRC probe into his tax affairs. The dispute concluded with a £5 million settlement, including a penalty. But on Sunday, Sunak sent a letter to Zahawi saying his ethics advisor had concluded there was, quote, a serious breach of the ministerial code. In the letter, Sunak also announced his removal from the post. The dismissal came as Sunak was under fire himself for initially standing by Zahawi before ordering an internal investigation. But the Premier defended his stance, arguing that integrity in politics was the reason he did not sack the Tory chairman in time.
I think that's the right thing to do, to ensure that we have integrity in politics, but to do that in a professional way, that's what we're doing.
But many Britons remain unsatisfied with Sunak's handling of the issue. They reason out that the Prime Minister, who acted within hours over his advisor's report, should have sacked Zahawi earlier.
Well, Nadeem Zahawi obviously should be thinking about his future, but I think the bigger question here is why the Prime Minister didn't act earlier, what he knew about this situation, and why he seems to be continuously putting the interests of his party above those of his country. He knew there were allegations about Zahawi for a long time. He then knew that Zahawi had been negotiating a deal with HMRC at the same time as he was in charge of HMRC as the Chancellor. So I think the biggest question today isn't actually for Zahawi, it's actually for the Prime Minister.
Sunak also faces scrutiny over whether he knew about the minister's tax affairs and when he was told there could be a reputational risk to the government after Zahawi's appointment in October. Now many, including former high-ranking officials, suggest that Sunak's premiership risks being brought down by scandals swirling around the Tories. One such is high-stakes parliamentary inquiry into whether Sunak's predecessor Boris Johnson misled lawmakers over Partygate. The sacking of Nadeem Zahawi comes as Sunak's government facing decades-high inflation and a wave of public sector strike while trailing badly in opinion polls ahead of an expected 2024 election. To many, the tax evasion of Zahawi has not come as a surprise. But for a prime minister who promised accountability, professionalism and integrity while taking office, this is just a disgrace. But what happens when governments, especially in so-called first world countries, are submerged in corruption? Many argue that politics in those countries are too chaotic to the point where things get out of hand, like what happened in the case of Zahawi. So the ironic situation is when a man briefly in charge of the treasury does not pay taxes himself while insisting that others must pay. Apart from that, the UK is already grappling with a cost of living crisis which has been unprecedented in a century. This, coupled with the skyrocketing inflation, have so far prompted hundreds of thousands of workers from various sectors, including railway, postal, dock, energy and medical, to stage walkouts over pay and working conditions. While workers' unions accuse the government of inaction and call for talks to resolve the disputes, workers want their pay in line with the inflation that is currently at the level of nearly 11%. The UK is also facing rampant food and energy costs. Some even struggle to make ends meet or even afford to put food on the table.
There's people around here who can't afford to put clothes on their kids' backs or food on their table, and that he has mistakenly missed an error.
Charities are stocking up duvets, sleeping bags, hot water bottles, and blankets because they know that people can't afford to heat their homes anymore. That puts in the spotlight the number of governments which one after another took the helm at number 10 and attempted to resolve the cost of living crisis, but to no avail. The much bigger question is that how can the Sunak government run the country when it is unable to cope with this and other crises happening over there? The situation in Israeli-occupied East Al-Quds remains volatile after a number of shooting operations there took the lives of at least 9 people and wounded several others. In the latest incident, 2 Israelis were wounded in an operation in the Silwan neighborhood of Al-Quds on Saturday morning. The Israeli Emergency Medical Services said one of those injured was in critical condition. The shooter, identified as a 13-year-old Palestinian, was wounded. The incident was the second Palestinian operation in Al-Quds in less than a day. On Friday, at least 7 people were killed and several others wounded in a shooting operation outside a synagogue in the Israeli-occupied East Al-Quds. Resistance movements hailed the operation. The Al-Quds Brigades, which is the military wing of the Islamic Jihad movement, praised the attack as a courageous operation. It said the attack was a natural response to the Israeli occupation and the regime's crimes against Palestinians. The Al-Quds Brigades said the operation is a testament to unity among resistance groups. Hamas also lauded the operation. The movement said the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will pay the price for any new mistake that Tel Aviv could make. Lebanon's Hezbollah and Yemen's Ansarullah movement also separately praised the action. The Friday incident followed a Thursday Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank, where at least 10 Palestinians were killed in cold blood by Israeli troops. Thursday marked the deadliest day for the Palestinians since the start of the new year. Israeli troops barred medical teams from reaching the area. Regime forces also stormed a hospital in Jenin and intentionally fired tear gas towards its pediatrics department. Separately, Israeli forces demolished a sports club in the refugee camp. All what is going on in the occupied territories is happening in the silence of the international community. The mainstream media closed its eyes to the deadliest Israeli raid on the Palestinian community in the occupied land this year, and instead, they took the side of the Israelis in the recent tensions. From the United States to Germany, to France and Ukraine, almost everyone expressed concern about the lives of Israelis during the recent violence. The storming of the Jenin refugee camp is indicative of the regime's aggressive nature in dealing with Palestinians, especially since the emergence of extremist ideologies in the Israeli cabinet. Many argue that the current Israeli cabinet is the most extremist ever since its installation in the occupied land. What highlights this extremism is the recent storming of the Al-Aqsa Mosque by Israeli far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir. Many brand the minister's move as the root cause of all the recent tensions between Israelis and the Palestinians in the occupied territories. The latest flare-up of Israeli violence in the occupied West Bank brings to the question the regime's motive behind such escalations. One presumption is that the regime is only after taking out the total Palestinian identity from their land. In order to do that, what could be better than suppressing them by imposing an all-out blockade on millions of Palestinians and blocking their access to the outer world? To support that presumption, it is enough to say that the Israeli cabinet is planning to deport Palestinian families, at least those who the regime deems as terrorists, from their own land. That's why it pushes ahead with its policy of demolishing Palestinian homes. Many are convinced that this amounts to utter collective punishment and ethnic cleansing. There is no doubt that what the Israeli regime is doing now in the occupied land, in terms of demolition and other practices, will definitely backfire. What could be around the corner for the Israeli occupying regime is yet another intifada waiting to happen. After all, Palestinian resistance has entered a new phase, and so many young people are taking part in the operations against the Israeli regime. grassroots Palestinians with no affiliation to any of the resistance groups are rising against the regime, like the Den of Lions. The Den of Lions is an independent armed Palestinian group operating in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. The group emerged in August 22 following the killing of a Palestinian man by Israeli forces. Anti-Netanyahu rallies are being held on a weekly basis, with protesters not caring about what is happening to the Israelis in the occupied land, but rather taking aim at a prime minister who is indicted on grave charges and is willing to evade laws to do whatever he can. All in all, point to a situation where things are pulling the Israeli cabinet apart and move the regime to an ultimate annihilation.
In an article published on Responsible Statecraft, it is said that the U.S. role in Ukraine has slowly escalated since the beginning of the war there almost a year ago, saying the question now is how far Washington is willing to go. When the U.S. involves itself in a conflict, it often finds it difficult to get itself out. For instance, it happened in Vietnam. The U.S. military advisors helping the South Vietnamese fight Viet Cong forces eventually became U.S. soldiers fighting an American war. Where in Afghanistan, an initial invasion under the pretext of fighting Al-Qaeda terrorists morphed into 2 decades of war and destruction that resulted in the death of hundreds of thousands of Afghans. The same scenario could be unfolding in Ukraine. Less than a month into the Ukraine war, the US President Joe Biden stated that the US and NATO allies would not fight Russia in Ukraine. However, little by little, Washington and NATO are creeping closer to the catastrophic scenario Biden had described as World War III. Biden had also claimed the US troops will not be sent to Ukraine to take part in the conflict. However, several current and former American intelligence officials told The Intercept back in October that there is a much larger presence of both CIA and US special operations personnel in Ukraine than there was when the war began, saying they are conducting clandestine American operations in the country that are now far more extensive. An 8-year Army Special Operations veteran, who is now an investigative journalist, reported in December that among those covert operations is the CIA's work with an unnamed NATO allies spy agency to carry out sabotage operations within Russia. Reportedly, the cause of the unexplained explosions that have rocked Russian infrastructure throughout the war. Meanwhile, the United States and its NATO allies have serially blown past their own self-imposed lines over arms transfers. At the start of the war, analysts cautioned that the overt supply of even small arms and light weaponry risks encouraging a wider war and possible retaliation from Moscow, while US officials ruled out more advanced weaponry as too escalatory. It took less than 2 months for the Biden administration to start sending these more risky tranches of high-powered arms. By the end of May, it was sending advanced rocket systems. In addition, NATO arms transfers have now escalated well beyond what governments had worried just months ago could draw the alliance into direct war with Russia, with the US and European governments now sending armored vehicles and planning to send tanks. Russia has warned the United States against its planned delivery of Abrams tanks to Ukraine. Anatoly Antonov, Russia's ambassador to the United States, has described the move as a blatant provocation against Moscow. He accused Washington of purposefully trying to inflict a strategic defeat on Russia. The warning came before the US announced the delivery of dozens of its main battle tanks to Ukraine. Two American officials have been quoted as saying that the timeline of any potential delivery remains unclear and could take months or even years. Washington has said previously that providing Abrams tanks to Ukraine is not feasible, citing difficulties in training and maintenance. Meanwhile, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has decided to send Leopard 2 tanks to Ukraine and to allow other countries such as Poland to send the same tanks from their own stockpiles to Kyiv. Until now, Berlin had been hesitant to send the Leopards or to allow other nations that have them in their possession to transfer them to Kyiv, with reports early last week saying that Germany would agree to do so only if the US provided its own tanks. The decision by the US to send its Abrams seems to have provided the political cover that Berlin had been seeking. Ukrainian officials have said the tanks would be a game-changer on the battlefield. The country's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has called for a large number of tanks to repel Russian attacks.
Today, by the way, there's a lot of talk about tanks, about modern tanks that we need, and about the way this shortfall can be filled. A lot of efforts, words, promises. But it is important not to lose sight of reality. It is not about 5 or 10 or 15 tanks. The need is larger.
Zelensky said that Ukraine's allies have the required number of tanks to strengthen the country's defense against Russia. Since the beginning of the war, Ukraine's allies have sent Kyiv tens of billions of dollars worth of weapons. Western countries have also imposed a slew of economic sanctions on Moscow. Now, by escalating their support for Ukraine's military, the US and NATO have created an incentive structure for Moscow to take a drastic, aggressive step to show the seriousness of its own red lines.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. This is The Last Savior. I am your host, Zainab. Today in our studio, we have had the privilege to invite our dear guest, Dr. Ali Alavi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you. It's a pleasure for me to be here.
Well, Dr. Alavi, in our previous episodes, we have been discussing the series of features that will be there in the Mahdavi utopia. And we talked about justice in detail, and we have been talking about the comfort of people. You discussed a bit in the previous episode. Now I want you to continue with this comfort and convenience. You said we have some narrations as well to support this claim.
Yes, we have been saying that one of the elements of the Mahdavi utopia as the wealth and comfort that people will face at that time. And we also said that whatever we are suffering from today is not due to lack of, let's say, resources and wealth in the society, but the problem is in distribution and in the management of such resources among the people to find their needs and to find whatever was their own shares. Moreover, at the time of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, the material desires and material needs of the people are not going to be belittled, because people to say that, okay, we are going to live in such a Mahdavi environment and Mahdavi utopia, mm-hmm. and it's not good to, let's say, to think of, let's say, material desires.
Yeah.
So we said that أَعْمَلْ لَدُنْيَاكَ بَقَدْرَ مَكْثِكَ فِيهَا. That is, while you're in this world, work for this world of yours as long as you're going to stay in this world, right?
Yeah.
So it's not, we are not going to be invited to isolation like some have been doing. I mean, I've chosen
that's,
such...
That's one of the wrong conceptions that has been going on in the, we can say they call themselves as sages, but they are not, and they have unfortunately, made these concepts very worse, that in Islam or in religions, one has to seek isolation.
Definitely. So Islam is not suggesting such wrong ways. Islam says, while up until the time that you are in this world, you have to work for this world of yours. We see that Imam of the age, Imam Ali alayhi salam, he was busy with farming. He was actually growing palm trees, and he was having his own agriculture.
Okay.
So it means that Imam of the time, and he was doing his own job. At the same time, he was the leader of the Islamic Ummah.
Yes.
Right? The Prophet of Islam also, he worked like ordinary people to earn for his own affairs. It's true that after his prophecy, Lady Khadija actually accepted a great part of the expenses of their life,
mm-hmm.
but the Prophet or even other Imams...
And they distributed that among the poor of the time,
yeah.
but they had been making efforts to...
Definitely.
...live.
So the same should be at the time of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. People should strive for their material needs and material
desires.
But it's not. But we have to make a balance between our material and spiritual desires.
All right. So this should not get dominant over
exactly.
the other.
Thank
That's
you.
Very important. We'll discuss more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. Shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand year old
Welcome back. You're listening to The Last Savior. I'm with Dr. Ali Alavi, and we have been discussing the key features of Mahdavi utopia. Well, Dr. Alavi, we have been talking about the comfort and convenience in that time, in that idealistic state.
People are not going to be belittled for whatever, let's say, material request that they have.
Yeah.
And as we see that even in the language of narrations, even in from an Islamic point of view, human beings can strive for their own material life as well, like
okay.
the kind of effort that they are making for their spiritual prosperity, right? The Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, here in the element of comfort and wealth, I want to refer to a series of a hadith from the Holy Prophet and other imams to see how beautiful that world is. The Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam says, may the Mahdi rise in my ummah. And in his time, people will achieve such blessings and prosperity that they have never achieved before.
All right.
You see, a kind of prosperity, this blessings and prosperity is not necessarily a spiritual one.
Yeah.
No, to most extent we can say that this is this refers to even
material one as well.
Because as for spiritual prosperity, human beings have not been deprived that much. I mean, at least the gate was open for that.
Yeah.
It's true with the absence of Imam, it was it was difficult, but at least the gate was not blocked like that of less immature ones.
Exactly.
And this welfare, the Holy Prophet says, I mean, what can be denote from the wording of the Holy Prophet is, and this welfare will include all people, whether they are good or bad.
Okay.
So all of the people.
But
will
in
be,
this world, in the current governments all around the world, we see the word welfare. If they are applying, these governments are applying, they are providing people with the loans, huge loans, so that they can make homes or they can educate their children.
But for the
entire life, they have to pay back.
Even these loans do not go to everyone.
yeah, exactly. That's what I was
people.
Saying. Since you said that it will be for all, we have governments who have welfare facilities for a few number of people, and that's also just welfare of name, because their bones get broken by just paying back.
The Holy Prophet again continues to say that may the sky rain on them frequently. Actually, this is an allusion to the abundance of natural gifts.
Blessings.
Yeah. And let the earth not hide anything from what grows in it. So the capabilities and abilities of the earth will be actually materialized.
Okay.
You see, this is the way that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala perfects His blessings in abundance for human beings.
Mm-hmm.
You see, it's good to think and ponder how important it is that with, let's say, advent of a person, an infallible, the earth will show that good face of it.
Wow.
So how should and why should we actually deprive ourselves with not making dua for him for his arrival?
As that you said in the many previous sessions before that, the best dua as per you is to...
The dua of Faraj.
Dua of Faraj.
And as we said that even from the language of some hadith, we understand that there is no dua except the dua of Faraj.
Yes.
Because if we have a problem...
All your other duas come under this umbrella of dua of Faraj.
Exactly. Ahsant. So, in other narrations, let's see what... the other narrations are actually telling us about the comfort of the people at the time of Mahdi Utopia. At that time, always there would be a talk of abundance of wealth. This is one hadith.
Okay.
There's everyone is talking to the other one. Wow, what is going on?
Okay.
Wealth is showering on us. You see? The next is that abundance of blessings, continuous rains, lightness and freedom from lightness and freedom from the heavy burdens of life. So many burdens of life are on our shoulders. Like, for example, well, I have too many installments to pay. I have too many, let's say, commitments to do.
Yeah,
I mean,
too many responsibilities.
So you will have a tranquil mind at that time.
Yeah.
Free from all these problems.
Yes, inshallah, we hope that time to come so soon, and since you're discussing the eagerness to witness that time gets more and more, we'll discuss more after a short break. Stay tuned with us. Welcome back. You're listening to The Last Savior with Dr. Ali Alavi, and we had been talking about great zone that people will be witnessing in the Mahdavi Utopia, and that's comfort and convenience.
Yeah.
Yes.
Moreover, I want to actually narrate the hadith that have been depicted that beautiful scene with regard to the comfort and wealth of the people at the time of Mahdi Utopia.
Yeah.
At that time, people will find their relief from sufferings. Again, among the people will be the talks of, for example, paying off our debts.
Yes.
What happened? Of all debtors, and paying off the debts of those who have faith. There is a special, let's say, condition in that.
Mm-hmm.
The death of the faithful are going to be paid.
Okay.
This is also, so it means that this faithfulness at least finds its benefit here.
Yeah, because a person is not able to pay his own debts right now.
Yeah.
Well, how about the paying?
So it will be compensated for him at that time.
Wow.
Again, there will be a discussion on the needlessness of human beings. And again, in another hadith, it is about the generosity and forgiveness.